everyone. This is your host, Travis Hornsby, and today we're going to talk about loopholes that are not loopholes. These loopholes could actually harm you if you tried to do them for your student loans, and they are very popular. People ask me questions all the time about, can I do X, Y, and Z with my student loans, sort of creative thinking. You might even say wishful thinking in terms of how you hope that certain things, certain tax laws or tricks can be used when they can't be. There's nothing worse than using a loophole than to find out that it's not only is it not a loophole, but it can actually hurt you. So we're going to cover that main idea in today's podcast episode. Before we do that, you know that I love answering your questions. So our listeners will sometimes go to studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and they'll record a quick question. And we're going to do two of those today. If you want to record one, remember you can go to that same URL and leave your own question. But today we're going to cover a question about closed schools and forgiveness around that, and we're going to talk about bankruptcy for the two listener questions. So question one, let's hear from Omar.
Hey, Travis. In light of Secretary Cardona giving more guidance towards student forgiveness for colleges or situations where students were harmed or defrauded, such as the ITT case in the past couple of months, I was wondering if you had any thoughts on students that attended Argos University or the Art Institute, which parents' organization is the Dream Center Education, or EDMC. I was hoping you can give some guidance towards any possibility for students to seek relief, given that the executive of the organization mishandled the organization and it had to quickly shut down. I'm wondering if there's a case for students there to prove harm. And besides, many students have already sought to sue to just have some forgiveness in some way, shape, or form. So just wanted to know if you have any thoughts on that, given that Secretary Cardona has given more guidance on the subject. Thanks.
Good question. So the big deal here is borrower defense to repayment. What is it? Borrower defense to repayment under the Trump administration was a completely different animal. Basically, you had to show that your education was essentially useless from the school that closed, that you were defrauded, and that you had in no way benefited from that education. You weren't able to transfer the credits. You weren't able to complete your course of study at a new institution. You were essentially, at a minimum, the same as you were off before going to the program. But, essentially you had to almost prove you're sort of destitute from the experience of going to this borrower defense or going to this fraudulent school. The borrower defense to repayment is kind of this idea that, happened because for-profit colleges tend to defraud students and tend to open up and pop up like crazy because you have federally guaranteed student loans that they take advantage of. The problem, in my opinion, with this whole thing, this whole idea, is that not-for-profit schools defraud and screw people over all the time, and for-profit schools are a big problem, don't get me wrong, but so are not-for-profit schools. And for whatever reason, this borrower defense to repayment strategy has typically only been applied to, for-profit schools or very sketchy not-for-profit schools, right? Like, you don't have, your Harvard University dental programs that are graduating people with $400,000 of student loans for a degree that pays $120,000. You might say, the borrower might say, hey, well, the school like misled me in terms of how much I was going to owe. They told me I was going to go owe X and I ended up owing Y. Well, that's not a legitimate claim for borrower defense to repayment. A legitimate claim is, that my school actively defrauded me, it closed down. And so there is something called closed school discharge. That's actually different from borrower defense to repayment. So closed school discharge is more of kind of like this automatic kind of thing that when your school shuts down, if you don't end up taking those credits somewhere in a way that benefits you, then that process is supposed to be a little bit more automatic. And so in the cases that they're mentioning, you have Argosy and that shut down, and then this, art institutes that shut down. If you haven't received school discharge at this point, then I think that there's no harm in going ahead and submitting a borrower defense to repayment application. You can do that by going on Google and just typing in borrower defense to repayment application. You'll see a studentaid.gov link that pops up, and you can go ahead and download that PDF and fill it out and send it in. There's no real downside to doing that. And if you do happen to be included in some sort of forgiveness, then that would certainly be awesome. You just don't want to get your hopes up. In my experience, you can generally handle these loans through an income-based repayment forgiveness strategy. So set your stuff up for that and sort of expect that you're not going to get the loans forgiven. But, if you do end up getting them forgiven, awesome. So go ahead and try for borrower defense repayment. If you went to Argosy, if you went to art institutes or some other, you know, for-profit school that shut down, apply for borrower defense repayment because you have a new administration, Biden administration, that is a lot more friendly to discharging student loans. You know, it's night and day. I mean, you know, you had tons of borrower cases that went absolutely nowhere in the Trump administration that are now getting processed very quickly in the Biden administration. So give it a try if you think your school defrauded you. I actually encourage people to report not-for-profit schools that told them false statistics to get you to enroll, right? I encourage people to submit it for that too. But generally, that's not how they're going to use it. The government's going to only forgive debt from people that they can identify were definitely defrauded by some fly-by-night school that ended up closing is the most common thing that happens. So good question. Now we're going to hear from Bob.
Hi, Travis. This is Bob. What do you think the chances are for the Fresh Start through bankruptcy law to pass? Thanks.
Okay, so this one is essentially the Bankruptcy Act, like with student loans. Is that going to change? Is this particular act going to pass? I think at some point the answer is yes, it will, but that could be a while. What do I mean by that? There's a lot of things that Congress supports that just don't go anywhere. And the reason they don't go anywhere is not because Congress doesn't support it, but it's because Congress is dysfunctional. And so you've got these big, ambitious bills that they want to pass with reconciliation because they don't have 60 votes in the Senate. And everything else, if it doesn't make it in that bill, just goes nowhere. That's kind of what the past several years, or I guess even decades, have been like. I mean, you sort of look at the Trump tax cuts, right? You know, a very narrow bill had to fit in the process of avoiding the filibuster, and then not a whole lot else got done. Same thing for the Democrats' bill with the $3.5 trillion stimulus, or $3.5 trillion, I shouldn't say stimulus, the health and education plan that Biden wants to do, President Biden wants to do. If it doesn't make it in that bill, right, a lot lower chance of things getting done. And what goes in the bill has to be pretty specific. It can't, you know, affect non-revenue items. So you could argue that bankruptcy, allowing the bankruptcy code to change to allow discharge of student loans, you know, that's something that couldn't pass this reconciliation sort of filter. In other words, you'd have to have 60 votes in the Senate for that to pass. I don't think that a Republican House of Representatives would support that. I do think, though, that there are the votes in the Senate to pass it, because you had Senator Cornyn, who's one of the leading Republicans in the Senate, voice some support to that. And I think a few other Republican senators have been supportive of the idea of amending the bankruptcy code to allow for easier discharge of student loan debt. That's something that might happen at some point, but I'll caution that generally there's better ways to handle student loans than bankruptcy. The only time bankruptcy, in my opinion, should really come into play for student loan debt is if you have private student loans that you just have been paying on forever that are just really weighing your life down. You can't get rid of them without severe pain any other way. Because if you have federal student loans, even if it's FFEL stuff, it's old, you can consolidate it. You can get it on a lower repayment plan, right? You can get it on a better setup. So if you have federal student loans, the bankruptcy code is not the way to go, because you'll wreck your credit for 7 years. You'll make life hard on yourself financially for no reason, because if you can put it on a really, really low monthly payment with an IDR plan and keep your credit intact, I would argue that's a much better plan, even if you could discharge it in bankruptcy. So that's a couple of my thoughts on that. Just don't get overly excited about bankruptcy code getting reformed at some point, because I think it will. But I just think that there's better ways to deal with getting your loans forgiven instead of going through the bankruptcy route, even if they decide to change the code and make it easier for people to forgive debt, student debt, and bankruptcy. Okay, so now the main idea of today's episode: loopholes that hurt. Loopholes that are not loopholes, they're actually harmful, or at best, they just don't help you with your student loans. So let's look at your home first. We're certainly in this super hot housing market environment. People like owning a house more so than any time else in my life. Anybody basically that bought a house a year or more ago has a lot of equity in their home, or at least most people do. And people that bought their home even in the past 6 months in some cases have positive equity, which is kind of nuts. So you're either somebody that has equity in your home, or you just recently bought your home, or you're, you know, renting or thinking about buying a home. You're in one of those sort of life stages. So a lot of the natural questioning that somebody might do is, okay, I've got $100,000 in student debt, but I bought my house for $400,000 and now it's worth $600,000. And so I've got all this equity in my home. Should I Can I do a cash out refinance? Can I do a home equity loan to tap that and then, you know, deduct the interest on my tax return? Because you can deduct mortgage interest on your tax return if you itemize. So that's sounds like a great hack. You know, tap out that, you know, home equity loan at a low interest rate, access that money to pay off your student loan, and then just basically roll your student loan up into your house. This used to be a thing. Back before 2017, I actually had a couple consults in 2016 that we recommended doing this because you could take out a certain amount of home equity money out of your home, and then you could take out that loan and you could deduct it on your taxes. And plus the mortgage interest deduction was a lot more valuable because the standard deduction was only $6,000 instead of $12,000. So it's a lot easier to get to $6,000 of interest on your mortgage if you had below that level, you know, of a standard deduction being lower. So that was the thing. Like SoFi even had a product where you could do this. They had a product where you could basically do a home equity loan with them or a refinance with them and then turn your non-deductible student loan interest into deductible mortgage interest. But you can't do that anymore. So now the rule is if you do a cash out refinance or a home equity loan, you have to use that money for a capital improvement project on your home to be able to deduct the interest. The original interest, like the interest on the original mortgage amount, remains deductible. But anything over and above that cannot be deducted. And there's also a limit now. No more than $750,000 is the limit on how big the mortgage can be so that you can still deduct the interest. So there's a couple of downsides that are not even related to the fact that there's no tax benefit on doing this. The main downside of that is student loans are forgiven if death or disability happens, whereas if you have a mortgage, it's not forgiven in the event of death or disability. So for example, if you have a $500,000 mortgage and you die, then your estate still owes that money. So the bank could basically repossess the house if for whatever reason your survivors couldn't afford to make payments, right? That's something that they can literally do. If you became disabled, you know, you cannot basically say, hey, I don't have to pay my mortgage anymore. We're going to forgive the mortgage because I lost my eyesight or had lost an arm or something. I mean, you know, it's kind of crazy, but you don't get it forgiven when that happens. Whereas with student debt, you do. So that difference in treatment of the forgiveness during cataclysmic life events, that's worth something. That's worth having that ability to have that debt forgiven in the event of death or disability. So that I would say is the main downside. While there's not a big advantage of rolling your student loan up into your mortgage, I will say this. If you're thinking about buying a mortgage and you've got a big down payment saved, should you take out a conventional mortgage or should you go another route? Keep this in mind. There's no limit on deducting the mortgage interest for a loan that you haven't originated yet. So what do I mean by that? So if you say you're buying a $500,000 house and you have $100,000 cash, and so you could put down $100,000, which is 20%, and the rest of that $500,000 house, $400,000 is the difference, that $400,000 would go on your mortgage. So you could deduct the interest on the mortgage interest from that $400,000 mortgage if you itemize, which means if you have enough deductions to put yourself over the $12,000 standard deduction amount to justify itemizing, then you could deduct that mortgage interest. If you have student loans that you're trying to pay off as well at the same time, you know, you might say, well, is there a way to do something smart from a tax perspective when I'm buying a house, given that I have student loans? And the answer is yes, you could utilize a low or no down payment mortgage. So these come in two different kinds. One kind is the kind that the federal government subsidizes, which is the, I believe they're called FHA mortgages. So with this mortgage program, you put down as little as, I think it's 3.5%, and then you have to pay PMI, which is called private mortgage insurance. And that generally is an extra, you know, 0.5% to 1% on top of your mortgage interest rate. You know, that's a pretty helpful program that can help people that generally might not be able to buy a house be able to afford to buy a house. The issue with that is the PMI is not going to be deductible if you're making over, I believe it's $109,000. So then that PMI part is not tax deductible. And people tend to not look on those offers very favorably because they view them as more likely to fall apart if there's a lower appraisal number. The appraisal doesn't come in where they need it to. Then they're assuming that somebody that's using one of those mortgages is not going to have the cash to make up the difference, and then the house sale will fall through. So those mortgages in general are not that great unless you don't have other options. What are some other options? Well, professional mortgages and doctor mortgages, also called physician mortgages. This is a program that will go away the next time we have a credit crunch, because it's just a program that you offer when banks are flush and they don't know what to do with all their capital, and they decide, let's offer this kind of a program, right? I mean, at least that's what I'm concerned might happen. Basically, the way they work is you have to open a bank account. Some banks, you just literally open like a shell account, put $50 in it. Some of them, you actually have to open an account and have a recurring contribution in it. What they do is they allow you to pay a lot less than 20% down if you fit into a certain occupational category. The most clear one is physicians and dentists. That group of people will have a lot of options where you can put down as little as 0% and get a mortgage for up to the full amount of the house that you're buying. And you get to deduct all the interest to the extent that it's below the $750,000 mortgage limit. So this is what we just did. We just bought a house. We bought a house in the low 700 range, and we financed it 100%. And one of the reasons we did it is because we're itemizing on our taxes, and because it's below that $750,000 mortgage limit, we're able to deduct all of the interest on our taxes. So our mortgage payment's about $2,800 a month just for the actual mortgage part of it. Of that, the majority of is interest, is usually is what happens in the early part of owing a house mortgage for 30 years. What's interesting is once you take into account the tax deductions that you get for itemizing the mortgage interest, the payment after tax benefits are factored in is actually only $2,000. And we were just renting a two-bedroom apartment paying about $1,800 a month. So it's kind of nuts that basically focusing on maxing out that tax benefit by taking out a lot more in mortgage debt than we could afford kind of works out pretty nicely from a tax perspective. So that's what I would suggest, is if you're paying off student loan debt, take advantage of a professional or a doctor mortgage if you can qualify. So generally speaking, the dentists and physicians will get the lowest interest rates that will be almost as low as what the 30-year mortgage rate is for the conventional financing. For people that are other occupations like lawyers, optometrists, veterinarians, different kinds of other kinds of professional degree holders, what you might get offered is a mortgage rate that's almost as good but not quite. So maybe it's 3.5% instead of 3, for example. Not all the banks will offer these programs to people outside of dentistry and medicine, but some do. And that's a pretty good program, because if you can turn that into deductible mortgage interest, that's a much better plan, paying 5% down, 0% down, 10% down instead of 20, because you'd rather have a lower amount going into your down payment so that you can have more money to pay off your student debt. Because remember, student debt is not tax deductible except for some token $2,500 student loan interest deduction that gets phased out really quickly once you start making more money. Keep that in mind. You can control how much you put down on your house. And if you're a student loan borrower, we recommend going with a lower down payment up front and to look into professional and physician mortgage options. And we have a new page for this. You can go to studentloanplanner.com/mortgage and check your state and see what programs are available in your state. So thought I'd mention that. Another loophole. We're going to keep going. These other loopholes are a little bit shorter because they might apply to fewer people, but I still thought it'd be worthwhile to cover them. This next loophole, what about rolling your student loans into your practice loan? Can you do that to get a tax deduction? So I don't know what it is, but people just are obsessed with the idea of making their student loans tax deductible. Not to say that wouldn't be awesome, it would be, but that's like probably, if I sum up like what is the number one desire people have with student loans, they want to make it somehow where they can just deduct it on their taxes. It's like the number one ask I get. Some of these loopholes are variations of ideas people have had to make them deductible. So you might say, okay, well, what if I want to buy a dental practice or a medical practice and I want to spend $1 million on that and I have $400,000 in student loans? Is there a way to convince that bank that's already going to give me $1 million? Is there a way to convince them to give me 1.4 so that I can take that extra $400,000 and pay off all my loans and then make that interest deductible on the whole thing instead of just on my business loan? So the answer to that is no. The reason is, if you're doing a business loan, to make it tax deductible, it's got to be for the purposes of the business, not for your personal benefit. So this can be a gray area sometimes. For example, one thing that I see very commonly done is CPAs will recommend leasing a Tesla or a truck through your practice, and then that makes it a tax-deductible lease. You know, there's actually like rules behind that where you have to use it X percentage for the business and X percent personal and everything. In practice, this is only going to become an issue if you're audited, and that rarely is the thing that comes up. And so a lot of CPAs that are more aggressive CPAs tend to really push that approach because it makes the client feel great, right? You're getting to have a tax deductible lease on a brand new car that's really fun to drive. And there's a little bit of gray area in the tax world, I think, as to, you know, how you do that, how you go about doing that, if that's totally legitimate or not. And so, you know, it does make sense that there are some gray areas where things might not be super clear. And I have had at least one CPA or one client with a CPA that might have encouraged them to do something like this. What matters is if you are audited, will it stand? And I think the pretty clear consensus of all the CPAs in the dental and medical space that I've spoken with have said, no, it would not. So you cannot roll your student loans up into your practice loan and deduct it on taxes. You just can't do it because it violates that personal benefits sort of clause to get your deduction on your interest for the business loan in general, because you want it to be tax deductible for the business and not get completely disallowed. Next, let's talk about a loophole of having your family pay for school. So grandma's got a lot of money. Grandma wants to pay for your school, and then you can pay grandma back at 0% interest. Or maybe, you know, grandma wants to make a little money and maybe pay her 3% instead of zero so that she can have some bond income. I get this a lot. And sometimes it kind of varies between two different flavors. One flavor is, you know, my parents or grandparents are fairly well off, but, you know, they want to help me out too, but they don't want to just give me the money for the education. Maybe they're not that well off. And so I'm going to borrow from my parents at 0%. They're going to pay for school and then I'll owe them. There's a couple rules with doing this. So technically, to have it not count as a gift, for gift tax purposes, you know, you have to charge an interest rate the IRS says. And then you also have to follow certain rules that most people really frankly just don't follow. And I think the reason why the IRS never says anything about it is because the gift tax and estate tax limit are sort of unified, and you can give away, I think it's up to $10 million now. It's a little more than that without having to worry about that. So since most people that are doing this are not anywhere close to that limit, I think most people just make the loan at 0% and it's sort of off the books and there's no formal anything about it and people just do it. And since they have way less than $10 million in assets, the IRS just doesn't really care. Just know that the formal way to go about it is you're supposed to have some sort of rate, interest rate that the IRS like deems every year, and then it's more formal process if you want that not to count as part of your $10 million estate tax exemption. So the real problem with this loophole is also, I think that I said there's two flavors of it first. The first flavor is, you know, you're borrowing from grandma. The second flavor is sort of like a immigrant story kind of a thing where the first generation comes over, pays for school for the second generation, oftentimes out of home equity. So like it's real common for me to see a first generation family have all of their savings tied up in their house or a lot of it. You know, a lot of times immigrant communities are disproportionately on the coasts, and those communities have had really big run-ups in home equity, right? So think about California. Certainly see this a lot in California, in the Asian American community. You know, you'll take out a cash out refinance and you'll take that money and pay for school, and then the kid pays the parents back. Regardless of what the strategy is for this, the biggest problem with this loophole is that people forget that the loans are forgivable. For example, if you're going into medicine and you're going to become a physician and you take out a bunch of money to pay for a part of your schooling and then you go for PSLF anyway, then all that money that your parent or relative borrowed was wasted. Totally wasted. If you do end up paying your loans back, well, maybe that's a little bit different. Think about that. Think about how PSLF is a program that forgives debt after 10 years of making income-based payments. You know, if you could get a lot of your debt forgiven, what would be so much better is for you to take the loan money and take the loan from your relatives and then pay it back at 0% interest and then go invest it instead. Sounds terrible, right? Or literally get an arbitrage of positive 1% by putting it in the bank, or positive 0.1 or whatever it is right now. I've seen this problem so many times. It happened to my own wife. So my wife is Asian American. Her parents I think, had some savings. I think they did more of a pay-as-you-go kind of an approach rather than taking out, you know, home equity loan. But they paid for a large part of her med school, and then she still had six figures in loans afterwards. And that money was all wasted because she could have gone for public service loan forgiveness, but for a combination of bad advice and not having enough to justify going for forgiveness, it just didn't make sense for her to do. That's kind of a personal loophole that's affected me in my life. Luckily, it ended up being fine. And so that's the good news, is if you did this loophole, it does end up working out like long term, because the parents had the money to give you in the first place, or you know, the grandparents had the money to give you in the first place. So that means that they are good enough with money to have a large amount saved up. And so they probably taught you those skills to get yourself to that position yourself. You know, it's certainly not a unrecoverable mistake, or, you know, or a irreversible mistake in terms of it ruining you, not anywhere close, but it is very inefficient. So just consider that, like, when you're going for PSLF or 20-year forgiveness, you want forgiveness, you want as much forgiveness as possible, and you'd rather take that money and use it for other things than just give it away to the government for free. So now let's talk about another fake loophole, or non-helpful loophole, I should say, borrowing from the Department of Health and Human Services. So you might have heard of this kind of loan, but it's called Loan for Disadvantaged Students, Health Professions Student Loan. There's other kinds of loans that are named various things. I have an article that's like the 17 different kinds of loans you can consolidate. Probably like 12 of them are from the Department of Health. What's so insidious about this kind of a loophole is the debt does not show up on the NSLDS forms. And a lot of people assume they're private student loans, and they're not. They are federal student loans, but they're not through the Department of Education. You know, the Department of Health, Department of, you know, Department of Education are like Russia and China when it comes to the student loan system. They don't talk to each other. Neither one knows about the other. So you could have 400,000 of loans from Department of Ed and 100,000 of loans from Department of Health, and you could consolidate both of them into one direct consolidation loan of 500K with the Department of Education and make it eligible for all the forgiveness programs. But you don't do that because you don't realize those private loans are actually not private loans, they're federal. That's one of the reasons why, you know, especially people that go through any kind of health professions programs, a lot of times it's worth doing the consult that we offer simply to just make sure the private debt you actually have is really private. It's not just straight up forgivable. Because that's always fun. You identify in a consult, hey, wait a second, those $50,000 of loans that's at this company called ECSI, actually you could consolidate that, get it on the direct loan program and make it forgivable 100% tax-free. And there's a very quick 100x return on your investment, right? That's just one example of a loophole that's not actually a loophole. Why do people take out loans from the Department of Health if it's not helpful? The reason is because the financial aid offices and the students are only focused on what the interest rate is instead of what are the terms of the loan. And that's a big deal. It doesn't matter what the interest rate is. It matters what are the terms of the loan. Going back to earlier, people borrow from their family because they can pay 0%. But does that loan have the ability to be forgiven tax-free? No, you have to pay it back unless it's a gift, right? But then it's not a loan. But that's over-fixation on the interest rate instead of the terms. So Department of Health interest rate loans are 5% generally. That's the giveaway, is they're usually 5% flat. Often they don't accrue interest while you're in school, and they even don't accrue interest during your grace period after school. So people will see those terms, and financial aid offices will see those terms on the loans, and they'll say, wow, I would be doing a huge disservice to my students by pointing them to the Stafford and the Grad Plus programs, because instead they could take out these Department of Health loans, and instead of paying 6% interest, they'll pay 5%, and that interest won't even accrue while they're in their programs. So it sounds like a great idea, but they're not eligible for forgiveness unless you consolidate them. And generally speaking, the financial aid offices that got themselves into the position of thinking these loans were good in the first place are also not sophisticated enough to realize that they're not helpful unless you consolidate them. So it's one of those sort of catch-22s. People that are recommending them are also not recommending consolidating them after school. It's totally fine to take out these loans during school. You just have to remember to consolidate them, and a lot of people forget or just don't realize you can do it. So beware when borrowing from the Department of Health for your student loans. Next fake loophole is the credit card student loan repayment loophole. So you might think it's a great idea to pay your student loans with a credit card. In some rare cases, there might be a way to defend it. Some places might accept it, but most all places do not. Most of them require you to do a bank ACH withdrawal because credit cards charge the merchant a 3% fee generally. If you have a student loan and you know you're paying your student loan with a credit card, the people accepting that are having to pay a 2.9% fee to Visa, even more if it's an American Express. And so they really wouldn't want to do that because the interest rate on the loans is probably like, you know, 3 to 10%. So you're giving up 3% of that to an interchange fee with a merchant fee. No, you're not going to do that. Now, what people sometimes do is they figure out a way to get approved for a intro APR rate with a big balance limit. And then they'll go and they'll borrow all their living expenses or even tuition on that credit card. And they'll hold on to that debt for 18 months. And then they'll move it to a new balance transfer card with a new 0% APR rate for another 18 months. And they'll do that instead of borrowing from the student loan program. I found out about this idea from a blogger who is now deceased. And, you know, and I think that she struggled with some mental health issues. And I don't want to go into more detail than that, but it's like one of those things that sounds like it's a great idea. It sounds like it could save you a few thousand in interest, but in reality, it's very anxiety-inducing to be doing this because you have to find a new card to roll the loans to. You have to find a new credit card with a new APR rate. And if for some reason anything in that plan breaks down, now you're stuck with $100,000 in debt at a 25% interest rate, and you're just getting crushed. And yeah, you could get rid of the debt a lot more easily on credit cards. You just walk away from it and you wipe it away and it affects your credit though. And then it wrecks your credit. And so that's not a good idea. So stay away from financing student loans with credit cards. It's generally a way to get burned. Next loophole that's not a great one is the marry rich loophole. I'm joking about this a little bit because what I really mean is using your spouse's money for tuition and living expenses while you're in school. So the reason why it's often a bad idea is because what happens if you could get this forgiven? What if you're going for PSLF or the 20-year pay program, right? Then if by using that money from your spouse to subsidize your living expenses and not taking up the max loan amount, then you're getting less of the forgiveness that you're entitled to. So it seems like it's a no-brainer to take advantage of one spouse working, one spouse not working while one's in school and maybe using that money to cover expenses. But the school gives you the cost of attendance budget and you can borrow up to it. So what I often will suggest instead is people go back for a grad school program and I'll say, wait a second, you're going to go for forgiveness anyway, which means yes, your spouse could pay for rent, but instead go ahead and borrow that money to pay for rent and then have your spouse spend that money investing in their 401k, maxing out their emergency fund, paying off any car loans that you might have, and just in general, fortifying your finances. So there's no benefit for being responsible when it comes to student loans once you've identified that forgiveness is going to be the right strategy when you graduate. So remember that because it's something that's easy to overlook because people tend to think about student loans like it's the 1980s and you've got to pay it all back. And so what's the interest rate? You know, how can we minimize the amount you owe? And that helps to a point, but once you're over that debt to income ratio 1-to-1 where you owe more than you're earning, then it becomes a little bit less of a thing to worry about. Next loophole that doesn't work as well as like it can work. So this one's one I'm going to say could work well even is going to a Caribbean medical or vet school instead of waiting for another acceptance. The danger of this is I've seen a lot of clients of ours have fantastic success going to Caribbean schools, making six figures. I even had one of my most successful clients, monetarily speaking, ever was a Caribbean med school grad who'd become a plastic surgeon making over $1 million a year. So it can work out really, really well. But the danger is a lot of times, a lot of their people don't finish the degrees and get matched into programs. So for example, if you are going to a school in the Caribbean and you have the option of waiting a year or going now, if you go now, just know that you've really got to pass all your exams and you've really got to be one of the top students in the class. Because if you're not, there's a chance that you might not match into a residency program, for example. You might not pass your USMLE exams and move on in the process in school. And I've had also a lot of clients that have gone to Caribbean programs and have come out with a lot of debt, nothing to show for it because they were not able to get matched into a residency or they were not able to pass their key exams they needed to get into that process. That's kind of a big deal, but the schools are not very good about disclosing this, and they don't really tell you this in some cases. that if you go, there's a chance that you might not actually be able to be a physician or a veterinarian. That's what I'm saying, why this loophole is kind of a good one, kind of not a good one. Because yeah, if you go to a Caribbean school because that's the only one you get into, and that allows you to become a physician or a veterinarian, that's wonderful, actually. That's a crazy good investment, because remember, your student loans are just an income tax, like a 10 to 15% income tax. So worst case, if you become a physician and you lose 10 to 15% of the student loans, well, hey, that was a great decision. In fact, if you were not going to make a ton of money with your bachelor's degree, and you did have an aspiration of being a professional, and that's the only place you got in, that'd be a great place to go, assuming that it works out where you get placement. But even if you don't, it's still just a percentage of your income. So it's kind of like a shot at giving it a try to become a physician or veterinarian. It's usually those two programs. And if it doesn't work out, you lose 10% of your income for 20 years. It's not great, but it's not life-ending. I mean, it's just an income tax is all it is, right? So it's by definition, it's manageable. Keep that in mind if you're considering, you know, a Caribbean program, that it can work out, but you also need to be careful about what are the schools telling you in terms of how many of them make it through to the next level. Okay, the next loophole that I've got, and the final one that I've got that seems like it'd be a great idea that doesn't really help that much, is, drumroll, working while you're still in school. Doesn't help. Doesn't help that much. How can I make this claim? Let's say you're in school full-time and you're doing a 20-hour a week job. That's $1,200 a month. It's just under $15,000 a year. So let's say you're in a physical therapy program, and let's say your $15 an hour job is some sort of high-end restaurant or retail that you're sort of doing on the weekends and on the side. Okay, so you have, let's say you have $20,000 of living expenses you're needing a year, and then $30,000 a year for tuition. So it's $50,000 a year. And so how much does this $15,000 a year help? Say you have a three-year program and you work 20 hours a week for 3 years to do this. So you'd borrow $35,000 a year instead of $50,000, because you're covering $15,000 of that from your work. So that's $105,000 total. Add in accrued interest and fees, and this person who's working part-time would have to borrow $120,000 to $130,000 instead of around $180,000. That's a difference, right? That's a lot less to battle when you're graduated. So let's say you come out and your salary is $60,000 to $80,000 a year. Well, guess what? Your debt is significantly more than your income. It's more than 1-to-1. It's actually more than 1.5-to-1 if you think about your debt-to-income ratio. So what's interesting is if you worked part-time while you're in school, 20 hours a week and full-time school, which is this huge burden, probably means you don't have a ton of a social life if you do this, you're probably going to go for forgiveness anyway in this scenario. So my question to you is, why did you bust your butt and work your tail off if it's not going to make a big difference in what strategy you're going to end up pursuing? Consider these same numbers for dental or medical school, and then you're talking about an even worse proposition of working while you're in school. Maybe you can make an argument for doing this if you're in a very low-cost graduate degree program, but why are you borrowing so much school when you're not totally focused on it because you're having other responsibilities of working a job that doesn't tie into your long-term plans that well? So my suggestion to most people is, if you're going to go to school, just go ahead and go full time and borrow from the student loan program to finance the whole thing. The only reason you should go to a graduate program is either if you think you'll really love the work when you come out that people do once they have that degree, or from a financial perspective, if you're looking at it from just money ROI, take away about 15% off of your expected earnings, you know, once you graduated. Is that income justify you going to school for it? So for example, like you're making $60,000 with your bachelor's degree, but you could go be a dentist and make $120,000. Well, take $120,000 and knock off 15% of that. So knock off $18,000. So you're making $102,000 net of your student loan obligation. Does it make sense to go to school for 4 years to come out and have a net income of $102,000 versus $60,000 with your bachelor's degree? Well, if you were going to go work for some random corporate place, if you didn't go into dental school, then it was super worth it to go to dental school because it's a more stable profession. You can make a good amount of money even being part-time. It's pretty flexible. You help people. You're not staring in front of a screen all day, right? So it can be a pretty rewarding thing to do. You just want to make sure that you consider that, you know, it's essentially an income tax, the student loans, when you're going to this program, so that you make a good decision. It doesn't make sense to think about, okay, well, I've I'm going to go, I've got $500,000 in dental school debt, and I've got to pay all that back. Well, then no, it doesn't make sense. Because if you pay that back, it'd be like $60,000 factoring in the interest per year in payments, and you're going to make $120,000 after taxes, that's $80,000. And so you're going to make $20,000 a year for 10 years. So it's so interesting when you look at it from the traditional mindset about debt and then look at it from the updated IDR-aware perspective of debt and then realize that actually it still makes sense to go to grad school in almost every case compared to the alternative of not going unless you have such a great idea for a business where you can make a bunch of money without even going to school. If people knew how the loan program worked, it would actually help low-income people in underrepresented minority communities a lot. Because you basically say, okay, I'm going to go to the cheapest undergrad degree program I could possibly find. That way I stay, you know, relatively close to the Stafford loan limits where I could theoretically graduate without having to take out private debt. And then all I have to do is I've got my federal loans. Well, now I've got federal loans from undergrad and hopefully almost no debt elsewhere. And I've got a bachelor's degree. And once you've got that bachelor's degree, you can go to any graduate degree program in America and borrow the full amount for living expenses, tuition, eating, everything you need, you can borrow under that program for it. And remember, the worst case scenario is as long as it's all federal loans, you're just going to lose at worst 15% of your income towards paying it back. And 15, what I mean by that is maybe you'll lose 10% for the student loan payment and 5% for saving for the tax bomb. That's what I mean by that. So pick any professional degree program out there. And be real, like if you go to a really fun school in a fun city, you get to be a student for 4 extra years and sort of delay adulthood a little bit. Hopefully have a couple more football seasons or a couple more camping trips or something like that. I'm not saying that it's not also really fun to work and make an income too, but when you realize how the student loan system works, there are a lot of loopholes. There are a lot of ways to take advantage. There are a lot of ways to make yourself way better off than you would have been otherwise. Even if you, for example, wanted to have kids in school or had kids already and wanted to go back, you can do that and even borrow more for your living expenses and cover the extra costs of having kids in daycare. One of the highest debt scenarios is when somebody goes to school and has kids and has to borrow for the living expenses for their kids as well, because then you can borrow even more under the Grad Plus loan program working with financial aid to do it. So there's all kinds of loopholes out there, right? But there's a lot of them that result in either not positive outcomes or actively negative outcomes. So what I would say to avoid, just to recap here, probably avoid working while you're in school unless it's for fun. In terms of going to maybe a for-profit school or a Caribbean school because you get into that one instead of a cheaper school but you're waiting, you know, if you believe in yourself, it would be okay to just go ahead and go for the Caribbean school, the for-profit school. If you're at all worried about it though, you might want to wait to make sure. When you're thinking about financing your school, don't feel like you have to marry rich. In other words, don't use your spouse's savings to pay your school unless you know you're going to have to pay it back anyway. And in that case, maybe. But remember that a lot of this debt can be forgiven, and so you don't want to pay for something that could be forgiven. Don't finance your school on your credit cards because it's not that efficient, and it can cause a lot of stress and anxiety, and that's not a good thing when you're thinking about getting your degree. Avoid borrowing from the Department of Health if you can at all help it, because you have to consolidate those loans to make them eligible for forgiveness programs, and a lot of people forget to do that. Another thing to avoid is borrowing from family. Again, unless you're very clearly going to pay back all your debt anyway, in which case, fine, go ahead. But in general, a lot of times this backfires where the family ends up paying money that could have been forgiven at the expense of Uncle Sam. Instead, your parents went into deep debt for it, and now you're going to have to help subsidize their retirement. Don't roll your student loans into your practice. It's not tax deductible. Don't roll your student loans into your mortgage. It's not tax deductible, and it's not forgivable if you die or become disabled. And those are most of my loopholes this week, folks. So if you want to ask a question, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail, and reach out just in general. If you have any questions or any suggestions for podcast episodes, we love to get them. I would expect that we're going to be grasping for straws a little bit, getting really good content for you for the next 2-3 months. And then we're going to have all kinds of stuff to talk about, right? Fed loan, getting fired, people having all kinds of problems with whatever the new servicer is that they choose, what's going to happen with all the restarted payments, about what kind of proof of income they're going to ask for. Oh my gosh, we're going to have a lot to talk about. Until then, I'm trying to talk about a lot of different things, maybe a little bit outside the scope of student loans, so it always could help use a couple ideas. So reach out, folks. And also, We're still doing a lot of plans right now, which continues to amaze me just because payments and interest have been paused for like, I don't know, like it feels like since Michael Jordan was playing basketball at this point. So it's like amazing that people are still booking a lot of plans, but they are. And I think in part that's a smoothing effect of people realizing that things are going to be nuts in January when everybody's asking for help at once. So getting a long-term strategy has nothing to do with the payment pause. So if you do need a plan, now is a great time to book one because you're going to get a lot of our attention because we're more available than we will be in January. Think about that when you're deciding about when to get your plan if you're trying to think of the right time. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a wonderful week.